You're listening to The Martial Brain, the podcast that explores the intersection between the martial arts, science, critical thinking, skepticism, and that wacky organ that floats inside our skull in a pool of cerebrospinal fluid, making life unpredictably inspiring, infuriating, and sometimes just batshit crazy. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. The evolution of the martial human. Or, okay, Mr. Science, if all martial arts styles evolved from monkey style, why is there still a monkey style? In this podcast series, I frequently refer to our amazing but imperfect human brain. How then did we come to possess such a wonderfully but strangely functioning brain? The answer is more than a billion years of evolution. Before our modern brain came into existence, more primitive forms of nervous systems evolved. Starting with nerve nets, like those sported by jellyfish, and growing in level of organization through nerve cords and small, early versions of brains, we eventually ended up with our modern human brain. The most recently developed parts of our brains, like the neocortex, are what makes us different from all but a very few other animals. For example, we are able to plan for the future. We are able to use language to communicate with one another far more effectively than other animals. And thus, when an individual has a good idea, it's less likely to die with him or her. Ideas pass on through language and over time become culture and technology. Technology like the martial arts. We are able to improvise tools and weapons from our environment at a far greater level of sophistication than other animals. How did the way we fight evolve along with our brain? Most animals do little real fighting within their own species. An animal that is injured in a hierarchically driven fight is less likely to be able to obtain food and fight off predators. Animals that are likely to behave in such a counterproductive way are less likely to live long enough to pass on this trait to their offspring. Thus, when animals do fight within their own species, they usually do so in a non-lethal form of ritual combat, full of posing and bluster. This fact has led to the evolution in many species of odd behaviors, like goats, deer, and sheep clashing horns or antlers, fur standing up to make an animal appear larger, gorillas pounding their chests, and countless other examples. Condescendingly, humans tend to find these ritual behaviors odd and even funny. But we do exactly the same thing. Watch two people, especially male people, before a street fight. It's relatively unusual to see fists fly right away. There's usually some sort of pre-fight ritual. Grievances may be loudly aired, staring contests with arms spread wide, pressing faces against each other, each in an attempt to get the other person to back down. Despite the fact that we now often find such behavior comical, it is ancient and useful, because the practice of the ritual usually takes the place of a real fight for determining which animal is dominant and which is not. So as it turns out, it wasn't Bruce Lee who came up with the art of fighting without fighting. When we were still simply hunter-gatherers, the ability to fight against other humans would have been far less important than the ability to prevail against predators and other animals we were hunting. Our proto-martial skills were used to survive in a wilderness world that was red in tooth and claw. After the agricultural revolution of about 10,000 years ago, many humans began to settle down into towns and cities. Over time, humans began to crowd the preferable living spaces on the planet more and more. This means that over time, it became mathematically more likely that a human would fight to defend himself against another human than against an animal. This changed everything. Humans are among the deadliest of opponents. Their ability to plan for the future means they can actually practice techniques to improve their fighting skills. Their ability to use language to communicate means they can form well-organized gangs and even armies. Unlike animals, humans can arm themselves with weapons. once used mainly for hunting, weapons were also important for a new phenomenon: warfare. New technology like copper and even bronze vastly improved the weapons. At about this time, technological and cultural evolution, rather than physical evolution, took over as the primary driver in the development of the martial arts. The martial arts were, by now, developing rapidly, and would continue to do so to the present time. Since my subject today is how our evolution led to the martial arts, I suppose I must address a related topic. I'm fully aware that not everyone, especially in the United States, accepts evolution as settled science. Nearly everyone who doesn't accept evolutionary theory makes that choice based on the ideology of their religion, and not based on examination of the scientific evidence. And that's fine. That's their choice. I have absolutely no desire to discuss or debate religion. It is outside the scope of this podcast. But when anti-evolution activists take the extra step and say that there is a controversy in science regarding evolutionary theory, they have crossed the line into the realm of scientific debate, which is within the scope of this podcast. Especially when they use the rallying cry, "Teach the controversy," and claim that they want alternative theories to that of evolution taught in schools to our children. Why not teach alternative theories to the germ theory of disease, the theory of gravity, or Einstein's general theory of relativity? If you look hard enough, I'm sure you could find a few proponents of such alternate theories. As a matter of fact, there is a group called the Flat Earth Society that cites an experiment from more than a century ago, as well as biblical text, to assert that the Earth is not a sphere, but a flat circle with the North Pole in the center. You can check them out on the internet. Shouldn't we teach the flat Earth controversy in our schools? Obviously, such a claim is extraordinary, and as Carl Sagan said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. The claim that there is a controversy among scientists about evolution is also extraordinary, but the evidence is decidedly not. There is no real controversy among scientists over evolutionary theory. The consensus among biologists for evolution is as strong as the consensus for any other foundational theory or law in any science. The folks who are fighting hard to force our schools to teach the controversy have scraped up a list of, quote, scientists, unquote, who don't accept evolutionary theory, in order to present a case that there is not consensus among scientists on this subject. This list totals 241 scientists. If you examine the credentials of the people on the list, you see that the list is padded to make it seem larger. Some of the, quote, scientists, unquote, only have degrees in philosophy. Many others get their degrees from small fundamentalist colleges that teach creation science rather than evolutionary theory in their biology classes. Let's be generous and give them the figure of 241 scientists anyway. The formation of this list prompted members of the scientific community to begin
Project Steve.
Project Steve put together a list of scientists who accept evolutionary theory, but with a catch. You could only be included on the list if you have earned a science degree from an accredited university, and if your first name is a form of the name Steve, like Stefan, Stephanie, Esteban, Spanish Steve, Etienne, French Steve, etc. As of a few weeks ago, the total of names on the list of Steve stood at 1,375 scientists. That's more than five times the number of the evolution deniers on the other list. Statistics show that people with forms of the name Steve make up about 1% of the population. If you follow the math, that means less than 1/5 of 1% of scientists refuse to accept evolutionary theory. 99.8% sounds like consensus to me. Let's look at a few more of the common arguments given by anti-evolution ideologues. One of my favorites is, it's not a fact, it's just a theory. This argument alone should be enough to disqualify the person who makes it from participating in serious scientific debate. It displays a complete lack of understanding of the meaning of the word theory when it is used in science. It doesn't mean guess. Let's accurately define some terms used by scientists. The first term is fact. In a philosophical sense, there are no scientific facts. Science cannot prove to a metaphysical certainty that anything is true. That is not what science does. What science does do, and does very well, is move our working models of the natural world closer to the truth by proving what is not true, or disprove rather than prove. If you have ever watched the TV medical drama House, you heard the phrase rule out, used over and over when diagnosing a patient. The classic scene in House has Dr. House using a whiteboard to list all the possible known diagnoses for the set of symptoms presented by the patient. Much of the episode then consists of Dr. House and his team gathering evidence that eliminates, or rules out, some or all of the listed possible diagnoses, ideally resulting in only the correct diagnosis. This is like a microcosm of science. A phenomenon is observed, and then possible and preferably plausible explanations for it are proposed. These possible explanations are essentially educated guesses, or hypotheses. Not, I repeat, not theories. In science, the word theory has a very different meaning than when the word is used in everyday life. Once a hypothesis is proposed, the real work of science begins. After a period, usually years, of data gathering, testing, and elimination of all alternative hypotheses, if there is a remaining hypothesis that withstood this rigorous process, then it is part way to being considered a theory. For the hypothesis to be fully considered a theory, something else is needed. Predictions must be made based on the hypothesis, and then exhaustive tests are conducted to see if the predictions pan out, not just once, but many times, by many different scientists. This is called replication. After the hypothesis withstands a certain amount of testing, word gets out through scientific journals. And soon, scientists from around the world are trying their hand at gaining notoriety by disproving it. When misguided people compare science to just another religion or ideology, they are not seeing the world that I have just described. Followers of the same ideology do not climb over one another in an attempt to prove each other wrong in the fashion that scientists do. Science is a jungle, red in tooth and claw. The vast majority of hypotheses do not survive this process. Anything called a theory in the world of science has robustly survived this trial by fire, usually many times, from many avenues of research, and it usually undergoes modifications in the process as more is learned. All of this happens to the hypothesis before it is accepted as a theory by a consensus of scientists. 100% consensus is never achieved. There will always be individual scientists who, out of personal animosity, ideology, or for financial reasons, will stubbornly resist agreeing with the overwhelming data. So when a scientist uses the word theory, what that means is as close to being a fact as nitpicky people like scientists are willing to admit. What about laws, like Isaac Newton's law of gravity? Many people hold the mistaken belief that scientific laws are stronger than and above theories in some sort of hierarchical ranking. No, laws are not superior to theories, just a bit different. Both laws and theories have overwhelmingly large amounts of evidence to support them. In that sense, they are equivalent. Laws describe natural phenomena, often very precisely with mathematical formulas. Laws do not explain the phenomena they describe, and are thus very narrow in scope. Newton's law of gravity gives no explanation for why gravity happens. It took Einstein to do that more than two centuries later through his general theory of relativity. Theories explain the phenomena they deal with. There absolutely are scientists whose language skills lack proper discipline and who are thus prone to utter intellectually lazy phrases like scientific fact or scientifically proven. This just illustrates that science is done by imperfect humans, hence the importance of testing and replication. So when someone states that evolution is just a theory, They have just unwittingly given a compliment to evolution and might as well, for practical purposes, have said, evolution is a fact. Some people show their ignorance of how evolutionary theory works when they say something like, I'll believe in evolution when I personally see a frog give birth to a rabbit. This statement is yet another example of the logical fallacy called the straw man, in which your adversary in a debate restates your argument using his own terms, usually in a simplistic or belittling way. Of course, you will never see a frog give birth to a rabbit. This straw man argument displays ignorance of speciation, or the process of the formation of a new species. Let's define another term. What is a species? People unfamiliar with the nuances of biology tend to think of members of a species as identical to one another, like interchangeable Lego blocks. The truth is that there is plenty of individual variation within members of a population. In one sense, the term species is an artificial term used by biologists to describe a group of organisms which can all breed with one another. This isn't a perfect definition, since wolves, a different species than dogs, can breed with dogs, buffalo with cattle, and so on, but is a common way to describe species. There are several major ways speciation occurs. One of the most common occurs when a population of organisms splits, with one part of the population moving into a location isolated from the other part, becoming its own separate population. This new geographic location sometimes has hazards and opportunities. Sometimes the new hazards are too much and the new population dies off. This is part of evolution too. Like a material incarnation of scientific hypotheses, more than 99% of every species that has ever existed is now extinct. If the population survives long enough, the forces of mutation and natural selection will cause it to change genetically and become more fully adapted to the new surroundings. If the population changes enough, its members will no longer be able to breed with individuals from the other population from which it split. Bam! New species. Yet there was never a case of a mother of one species giving birth to a member of another species. The change is much more gradual. Think about this. The very fact that you are alive, listening to this podcast, means that a living mother bore you, and a living mother bore her, and so on, all the way back in an unbroken chain for hundreds of millions of years. Each child was the same species as its mother, and yet you are not the same species as your maternal ancestors from a mere half a million years ago. Those species that now exist are descended from winners in the genetic lottery, who successfully adapted when faced with climate change, disease, predators, or any of the rest of the myriad threats to the continuation of life. The last silly but very common argument from folks who don't accept evolutionary theory goes something like this. If we are descended from monkeys, why are there still monkeys? First of all, at the risk of nitpicking, we are not descended from monkeys. We share a common ancestor with monkeys. It would not be precise to call that ancestor a monkey, although to the layperson it might appear monkey-like. Of more significance, as I stated earlier, speciation usually happens when part of a population splits away and becomes isolated from the rest of the population. What happens to the new population has zero effect on the old population, although it may also be adapting to changes in its environment. Thus, when speciation occurs, the old species doesn't automatically die off as if some cosmic switch had been thrown. That's it. Normally, I finish an episode by saying, anyway, that's what I think, and so on. But the points that I have made to you today are far more than opinion. They are backed by data and statistical analysis. Let me know what you think at my website, rpmartialarts.com. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. The Martial Brain is produced by Raging Squirrel Productions in association with the Rising Phoenix Martial Arts Academy. If you like the podcast and would like to help it grow, go to iTunes or Stitcher and give it an honest rating and review. Contact me with questions about the Marshall Brain or the Rising Phoenix Academy at our website, rpmartialarts.com.